Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guests are Jimmy Soni and Rob Goodman. Jimmy served as an editor at the New York Observer, the Washington Examiner, managing editor of the Huffington Post. His works appeared in Slate, The Atlantic, CNN. Rob's written for Slate, The Atlantic. His scholarly works have appeared in History of Political Thought and the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal. Together, the two have co-authored work appearing in Politico, The Huffington Post, and The Atlantic. Their first book, a biography of Cato the Younger, was titled Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar. Today we're going to be talking with them about their latest collaboration, A Mind at Play, How Claude Shannon Invented the Information Age. Now, the name of Claude Shannon, 1916 to 2001, is not a well-known one and is not the man that people generally think of when pondering how we got to where we are in our digital age. But when Shannon was only 21 in a master's thesis, he figured out that instead of using mechanical switches, a true computer would make use of electrical ones that would not only control the electrical flow of intelligence, or information, if you will, but would perhaps fake being a real human brain. This may seem like old stuff now, but this was written back in 1937 or so, before almost anyone thought of the world in anything but analogies, the way that many of us still do our mental arithmetic or tell time. Here was someone ready to usher us into a digital age, an information age, long before there were the tools or the minds able to grasp the concepts that he was propounding. That alone would be a legacy to remember a man for. But Shannon went on to work during World War II as a cryptographer, meeting and becoming friends with Alan Turing. He did all kinds of other cool stuff, including his lifelong interest in jazz, his fascination with juggling, so much more. His invention of the ultimate machine, the box we all know of where the hand comes out and turns the switch off. Fortunately for us, these two guys decided that this was a life worth looking at closely and have given us this biography of a genius, a code breaker, a mathematician, an oddball of sorts, and most importantly, the father of the age we now find ourselves smack dab in the middle of. So welcome, guys, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Really,
thank you for having us.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
So why do you think he was so, prior to you, unsung?
Well, one of the things that comes out in our study of his life is he preferred it that way. In the mid-1950s, this is an era in which scientists are achieving some fame. This is the post-war era. Scientists advise presidents, they made the bomb. And so the public figure of the scientist is reaching its apex. And Claude Shannon is one of these rising scientific stars. He's young, he's handsome, he works at Bell Laboratories, which is really prestigious, and he has the chance to be famous. They put him in magazines, they put him on TV, and all of this is happening, and they're sort of forking the road. He could have become a sort of celebrity intellectual, or he could choose not to go down that path, and unlike, I think, what many people would do, Claude Shannon decides it's just not for him. He becomes a professor at MIT and lives a largely private life for the next 40 or 50 years. And it's an extraordinary thing to think about because he was someone who could have had the household name recognition of someone like an Albert Einstein or to some degree a Richard Feynman. And instead he decides, no, he's got all these curiosities that he's going to pursue and there's no real need for him to go in to try to become famous. And so he actually purposely steps off the stage. The second reason I think a lot of people may not know who he is because, you know, it's easy for us in our minds to think, you know, Steve Jobs, iPhone, Bill Gates, Windows. It's less tangible to think Claude Shannon, bits, or Claude Shannon, you know, computers can perform logic. There's a kind of intangibility to the work, and that's part of why I think it's harder for us to wrap our heads around. This is very dense stuff, and it's theoretical, but it has really practical implications for all of us. And obviously, his being unsung is the reason that we decided to take on this project, because we felt like we owe this guy so much. His fingerprints are all over the modern world, and yet we don't know who he is. There was something ungrateful about that for us, and we decided to go look at his life, which turned out to be just as interesting as advertised.
Yeah, it's funny because when you look at his quotes, which, you know, you find a lot of quotes from him, and he's a difficult man to find quotes from, he seems almost totally disinterested in answering the question and, like, really just not, you know, leave me alone almost. His language, when you read between the lines of it, is almost like, you know, I'd rather you hadn't asked me the question. I'm not really interested that much in what you're talking about.
Yeah, that was one of the challenges of learning about Shannon's life, was that he was such an evasive interview subject. You know, of course, we didn't interview him ourselves, but we had access to a number of interviews, both published and unpublished, that people had done with Claude Shannon. And he was always just a little bit coy. He just didn't like talking about himself. And part of it was humility. Part of it was he just didn't really have the time of day for people who weren't on his scientific level, which didn't mean he was rude. It just meant that he didn't go into a lot of detail. So we had to really suss out who this guy was from talking to his family, from talking to some of his surviving colleagues and friends. One of our favorite quotes was someone said, that, you know, this was a Mel Labs colleague of his, said that, you know, if Claude Shannon had wanted to, he could have been the world's best con man. And we mentioned that to his daughter, and his daughter said, oh, he would have taken that as a compliment. So I think that kind of speaks to this sort of evasive, playful quality that Shannon had, and this quality of just kind of being unassuming at the right moment. So I'm glad he used his powers for good, not evil.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, the title, A Mind at Play, it's almost as if he wasn't... Well, you know what was interesting to me was his attitude towards the war when he went to work for Bell Labs. It was almost as if the war didn't really... Almost like a childlike outlook. The war didn't really concern him. He wasn't really thinking about the implications of what could happen to the world because of World War II. He wasn't interested in that aspect of it, was he?
Yeah, you know, there's sort of two parts to this. The first is that he isn't really interested in questions of politics and geopolitics. The war to him was it affected his life in as much as he did not want to deploy. He thought he was self-aware enough to know he was frail, and he preferred his own company, which would have meant that, you know, living with a bunch of people in tight quarters in a barracks would not have suited him. He also thought that he could be much more helpful and beneficial to the United States war effort if he was doing mathematics. And so, in as much as the war affects him, it makes for a brief period where, when there's the possibility that he's going to be drafted, you know, he's pretty anxious about it. Fortunately for him, and I think for us as well, he is given a wartime contract to come and work at Bell Laboratories, which at the time was, it went from 3,000 employees to 9,000 to support the war effort. And he ends up working on a research project on fire control. And fire control is essentially how, using the Navy's vessels, will you shoot things down from the sky, which involves a very complex set of calculations. And Claude Shannon contributes to that effort in that way. There is a way in which he's a little bit distant from the war. He could have had the same kind of active scientific participation that many of his mentors did. Vannevar Bush becomes a close advisor to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Shannon, he was one of Shannon's graduate advisors. If Shannon had wanted, he probably could have landed himself in a plum position in Washington, D.C., you know, rubbing elbows with politicians and talking about, you know, the importance of science for the war effort. But he really doesn't want to do that. What he wants to do is pursue these private questions about communications that he's had in his head. So to the extent the war was anything, it was a moment of real anxiety that he was going to be drafted, and then a distraction from the work he actually wanted to pursue.
You mentioned Vannevar Bush. In some ways, if it wasn't for Bush, you really might not have ever heard of Claude Shannon, right? He kind of was his super mentor.
Yeah, Bush was really a pivotal figure in Shannon's life. And the great thing about Bush is not just that he's a remarkable scientist in his own right, but that he's just a great scientific networker and organizer. That especially comes into play in the war years when Bush is probably the pivotal figure in organizing the scientific and mathematical war effort on behalf of the U.S. government. One of the popular magazines at the time called him the General of Science, which I think gives a sense of his influence. But a little bit earlier than that, when he worked at MIT, Bush was just really well known for having an eye for talent. Claude Shannon had not really been in the elite circles of mathematics before coming to MIT. He graduated from the University of Michigan, which was
a great program in math and engineering, but a little bit outside of Bush's orbit. And yet when Claude Shannon applied for a graduate position at MIT, Bush sort of immediately recognized how much raw talent Shannon had and put him to work on a really important project, which was overseeing one of the earliest and most important analog computers. This was a computer that solved equations, in a sense, by acting them out. You know, in the years before computers were made up of the digital switches Jimmy was talking about, computers were made up of shafts and then gears and strings and pulleys, and they output graph paper, graphs drawn on lined paper rather than actually numbers or text or anything like that. So Bush is someone who recognizes that Shannon is someone with the capacity to help improve this machine, brings him on board at MIT, and this is where Shannon develops his famous master's thesis that Jimmy referred to when he's just 21, that gets into how we can actually use digital switches to not just improve analog computing, but to build an entirely new and more efficient kind of machine, which is just the basis of all the computers that we're using today.
Yeah, I guess, and that's the crux of the book, is ones and zeros. And I guess for our audience, I guess the question really is, what was the transition? I mean, you had these mechanical gears, and we talked a little bit about before the show began, you know, for a while speedometers and cars were just arrows, and they told you where you were and where you were going and where you were at the moment. And then it became, for 20 years maybe, just numbers, digital numbers. But people didn't like that. So now you have speedometers that go back to the old-fashioned way. So you can look at things in terms of gears and pointers and levers and things like that, or you can look at things in terms of ones and zeros and achieve perfect accuracy. How did that transition actually occur? Was it because of a master's thesis written when you're 21 years old?
I think it probably is a bit of a stretch to say that it's entirely due to Claude Shannon's master's thesis. I mean, his 1937 paper is incredibly important in the history of computing, and it pushes thought incredibly far. But obviously, it took other minds and talents to take that work and bring it to, you know, the iPhone that I'm talking to you on. I will say that there's something about his discoveries that it has the sort of quality of incredible scientific discovery, which is it looks really trivial, but it only looks trivial after someone's come up with it.
Right.
And so, you know, this is sort of, it has a kind of Earth rotates around the sun quality. Like, we all take that as a given. But that wasn't a given for a long time. And for a long time before Claude Shannon, there was no connection between the world of, you know, Boolean logic and circuits and computing. And so there is a marriage that needs to happen. And in an interesting way, Claude Shannon is probably one of the few people in the world equipped to do that. So as an undergrad, he studies philosophy, and he studies George Boole, and he studies logic. So he understands true-false statements. He understands, you know, ones and zeros statements. And then he's also somebody who's very practically gifted. He spends his whole childhood as a tinkerer. He builds things. It is a joke that sort of all of the broken radios in Gaylord pass through Claude Shannon's hands. And he's also, at the time, working on this differential analyzer, and he's seeing all day, you know, endless days of these switches, open, close, open, close, open, close. And when they're open, electricity passes through. When they're closed, it doesn't. And this insight travels into his mind. He says, these two things are connected. You can connect logic with circuits. We can connect, call it sort of the software with the hardware. And that someone had to think that. Someone had to have that thought. And at that moment in time, a 21-year-old who was, you know, mechanically pretty talented and also had the kind of theoretical mind that you need to think those things was at MIT working on a computer and saw that insight and wrote it up. And so I think there's good reason why it's called the most consequential master's thesis of the 20th century. But I will concede that it's a series of pretty big steps between that and where we are today.
Well, and then also, and then the next step would be a mathematical theory of communication, correct?
Right, and this is Shannon's, probably his masterpiece that comes out in 1948, and what Shannon's interested in doing there is exploring what every system of communication has in common and what every message has in common. It was based on the thought, which didn't originate with Shannon, but he really kind of brought it to completion, the idea that if we can think objectively about what information means and what is the information content of a message, then we can achieve some remarkable gains in speed and compression and accuracy. And what Shannon basically does in this paper is show that every communication system is about encoding messages for transmission and dealing with noise or distortion in the channel where they're transmitted, and then decoding them on the other end. And then if we can figure out how to encode messages into bits, which is a concept that Shannon invents, then we can actually come up with codes that are in essentially ones and zeros that help us get those messages across more efficiently than anyone ever imagined. And that's essentially the insight behind why we can do digital communication, why we can compress DVDs into web videos, why we can communicate on the internet. Shannon is the intellectual architecture for all of this. And one of the remarkable things that we use to sum up what this paper does is that no one had really come up with a measurement of information that worked in all cases before Shannon did. He came up with the bit. He called it a binary digit, but one of his colleagues at Bell Labs suggested a bit because it was a snappier sort of abbreviation. Shannon said, okay, we'll call it a bit. But the paper does so much more than that, but we like to use that as a useful shorthand for what's so special about it, because it pictures things that we just take for granted and are around us all the time. But before Shannon, no one really knew what it meant to say how much information to use in this thing. Shannon's the one who can show you can measure the amount of information in the human genome or the Library of Congress or a book or a video or a phone call or whatever you want using exactly the same measurement.
Yeah, it's funny that when you look at the diagram that you guys replicate of the transmitter and the receiver and the signal and the noise coming in from the like almost like a 90 degree angle, it does look obvious, doesn't it? It looks like, okay, well, yeah, this is clearly an overlay for almost every problem or ever any issue you ever may conceive of. But it's, as you said, it's not obvious until somebody does it. But that diagram really is kind of like the crux of the book, isn't it?
It is, and it's actually interesting that when the paper is published, it's exactly what you said. Which is a credit to you, because you're one of the first people that we've interacted with to notice that it's a very flexible model. And it's a very simple diagram, but this is 10 years of thought that went into that particular diagram. And once Claude Shannon publishes it, it gets used in other fields. And so it gets used in biology, and it gets used to measure bird song. And to study bird song, it gets used in all kinds of places where it doesn't necessarily belong, but people love the elegance of it. They love the simplicity of it. But as we know, with many things that are simple, there's a great deal of complexity that's underneath them. And the architecture of his 1948 paper is certainly one of those. It's not just a diagram. As Rob mentioned, there are other pieces to it as well. But there is that particular piece of it is very profound and has implications not just within the field of engineering communications, but outside of it. And so in publishing the book, one of the things that's happened is we've heard from people in a diverse array of fields, psychology, data science, who say, oh yeah, I use Shannon's work all the time. It helps me kind of crystallize my thinking. And so there is something remarkable about that sort of discovery that has that broad of applicability. Even Shannon himself was a little bit concerned about how widely it was being used. We still think it just speaks to the remarkable intellectual achievement that it was.
Yeah, that's like kind of like towards the end when he kind of wants everyone, as you guys say, off of his bandwagon. You know, it's like, okay, I did this. Let's leave me out of it now. And then he goes on, and then to tell a little bit about what he goes on to do, like with Vegas and with the with jazz and with his mechanical things. Tell a little bit of that stuff.
Yeah, well, the neat thing about Claude Shannon is that he had freedom to pursue his intellectual interests and curiosity wherever it took him. And, you know, he could have used that freedom to work on becoming more of a celebrity, to work on burnishing his name recognition PR, but what he really did was he pursued his original love, which was tinkering and making things and solving puzzles. So we mentioned about Vegas. This is something that's also discussed by Ed Thorpe, who was his collaborator on this. Ed Thorpe was a colleague of Shannon's who came to him with the idea of building a mechanical gadget that could help you beat the house at the game of roulette. And Shannon, because he's just the ultimate tinkerer and already had a two-story tinkering room attached to his house, thought this was an awesome idea. So he tells Thorpe, yeah, let's do it. So they spend months and months hammering away at this. And what they come up with is one of the world's first wearable computers, arguably the very first, which attaches to the body and actually communicates to the user through headphones where a roulette ball is likely to land. And what they do is they divided up the roulette table into about 8 segments, and you could figure out, based on where the ball is dropped in, where it's likely to end up. And if you can just carve out an eighth of where you think that ball is going to land, you can dramatically improve your odds of being in the house of roulette, and you can actually make a really good profit on it. So Shannon and Thorpe and their wives actually take it to Vegas to test it out, and they do quite well, except for one moment when Thorpe has the earbud peeking out of his ear, and someone thinks it's an insect and screams at him, because earbuds hadn't really been a thing at that point in the 60s. So they actually, other than that brief scare, they do quite well with it, but they eventually decide to dial it back because I think one or the other had a conversation, which they realized that most of the casinos in Vegas are run by the mafia at that point. So if they were ever caught cheating the house or taking advantage over the house, they'd probably be taken to a back room somewhere, and that wouldn't end up well. So they decide to discontinue the experiment, but it's just an example of what Shannon did with the freedom of being such a successful scientist. He didn't really pursue giving whatever the equivalent of TED Talks were in that day. He just liked to work on projects. So other things he made were the chess computer that we've talked about, the ultimate machine that you mentioned, which is just sort of a little a trick gadget that would turn itself off and do nothing else. He built a calculator that worked using Roman numerals. He built a flame-throwing trumpet. He built a fleet of customized unicycles. to the very end of his life, he loved working with his hands, and he loved making things. So we even discovered late in this project that there was a tree on his property that Shannon carved into a giant flagpole that flew a pirate flag, just because why the heck not? Oh, there was also a ski lift that he helped rig up that would take you from his house down to the shore of the lake nearby. So anyway, he just loved to play around and loved to tinker, and he did that with the freedom that he had in his work and research life. But we also think that it was part of what made him such a successful scientist, that he was someone who asked sort of the playful, silly, childish-sounding questions, which turn out to be the most scientifically productive questions. We say in the book that it's by asking, stupid-sounding questions, like why don't apples fall upwards, that we get some of the deepest scientific insights. And Shannon was the kind of guy who always knew what ridiculous questions to ask and would get the most results.
Yeah, and then as a sidelight, you also say, you know, all famous men who come up with ideas like this always have their naysayers. And this guy, Doob, I mean, it's a perfect name, too. I mean, who was he, and how did he come up with, and what was his reputation? That was just a great sidelight that I enjoyed reading about.
So Joseph Doob is a mathematician at the time, and he's actually, he is both a critic of Shannon, and he's a good stand-in or a good representation of the kind of criticism that Shannon got. So Shannon had this had an intuition, a very strong mathematical and scientific intuition. And like Einstein and others who have this sort of level of thinking, he would see solutions to problems in his head. He would have answers in his mind, pictures in his mind that he was able to see. And he had gotten, that was the answer. He had figured out the problem or the thing he was trying to tackle. And he would see the answer, and the intervening steps for him were just a sort of a distraction, an unnecessary thing that he had to finish. And so he often, when he was writing papers, made logical and mathematical leaps that disturbed and upset many of the mathematicians like Joseph Doob, who would have preferred more mathematical rigor in the paper. The irony of this is that when the paper lands, there are a couple of criticisms like Doob's, which say, well, this paper is not mathematically insufficient. In fact, Doob's critique said something like, I don't believe the author's mathematical intentions were honorable, which is about as scathing a criticism as you can write in an academic paper, I think. The irony is, on the other side of it, the engineers say that the paper is too mathematical, that it has too much in it. And so Shannon manages to sort of find this middle ground. It does come to pass later that people come along and do the intervening mathematics that Shannon couldn't bother himself with, and discover that not only had Shannon been right, but he had been dead right about basically everything. And he knew that he was right, and he just didn't feel the need to prove it to anybody. And so his proof, one of the folks we spoke to said his paper was weak in what are now referred to as converses. And so he just didn't seem, he didn't feel the need to explain himself in as much rigor as a mathematician like Doob would have liked. The story has a happy ending in that Doob accepts, for one thing, that he's a kind of critic about everything. He also is the person who gives Shannon a pretty prestigious award at a conference. And so we can't imagine that he would be on stage with Shannon handing him this award if he hadn't eventually come around to the idea that Shannon had been right about the mathematical theory of communication. But it's an interesting thing to see that moment, to see how Shannon handles it, because honestly, we don't have any record that it fazes him in the slightest. Only in later interviews does he say things like, "I don't think they quite understood what I was talking about," and that's about all he says about it.
I know, it's almost like Gary Cooper. You know, it's almost like he just says, "No, I don't think he got it. I don't think he understood what I was trying to say." But there's no. You know, there's no venom. I guess that's the word. There was never any venom in what he says in response to any of this stuff. It's just like, no, I guess they just didn't know what I was talking about.
He allows a lot of things like that to roll off his back, partly because he has such intense curiosity that the moment that he's finished with something, he basically moves on to whatever the next thing is. So all of the criticism, the back and forth, the noise that would happen after he completed something just didn't affect him because his mind had already trained itself on some new problem. And so by the time some of these critiques come around, you know, Shannon's busy working on artificial intelligence. He's busy building Theseus the mouse. He's busy pioneering early computing, learning about investing in stocks. And so in a way, he manages to powerfully distract himself from the kinds of things that would probably get to the rest of us. I assume it also helps that, you know, there were no comment sections on academic papers, so he didn't necessarily have the chance to see everything that people were saying. But a big part of it was he just didn't feel the need to explain himself to critics.
That's funny. You just overlaid your own diagram on the diagram because when you said he didn't pay attention to the noise, you know, it's like he had his own compensating device for the noise that was coming in from Doob at right angles to his work. That was interesting.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of Shannon's academic career was about overcoming noise, was about penetrating through it. And maybe it's a metaphor they wouldn't have liked, but you know, when people at the time were saying that the conventional wisdom solution in dealing with noise was just talk louder, put more power into the system, Shannon was just saying, "Well, no, it just depends on what we say. That if we can organize our messages better." We can actually defeat noise that way. And maybe it's a stretch, but you could say that Shannon was never one in his personal life or his scientific life to talk loudly. He was one to deliver the most concise, best organized, most elegant message possible. And that's something that really remains to this day in his work. Even though he's not quite on the frontiers of cutting-edge technology anymore, people still go back to read his papers for the inspiration of how to write an elegant, concise, crystalline sort of scientific investigation. And that's worth reading, even for those of us like Jimmy and I who aren't mathematicians or engineers by training. And it's also worth reading for those who are in the math and sciences who just learn by watching the greats.
Well, here's an oddball question then, if we're talking about noise. And we were talking before about the difference between analogy, analog, and digital. And so now you go into Barnes & Noble, and all of what was CDs is now 180-gram pressed vinyl, and everybody's going back to records because they believe that the sound is better. Not that it's more accurate, but that it's better. But yet, it's impregnated with noise. And so I guess my question is, you know, you say, the reviews all say that Shannon was as oft-times compared to M.C. Escher and Lewis Carroll as he was to Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein. So, like, what about that? What about the fact that people sometimes seem to prefer an analog way of, and you talked about this before a little bit, about the fact that people seem to prefer an analog way of looking at things, even if it doesn't present you, and this has nothing to do with the book, even if it doesn't present you with the most accurate of outputs?
I do think that there's something... I think there's a great deal of merit to what you said. And I think that, look, if I can speak personally, I mean, there are times when I would love to go back to a flip phone. And I have, and that's certainly not an analog step, but it's a gesture in that direction. I would love not to be inundated by messages and tweets and beeps and emails and all the rest. I think it's probably a bit sort of simplistic and crude to talk about to say that Shannon was taking us to a future that we didn't necessarily want to get to. I think that in every era, there's small groups of people who, you know, prefer some sort of point in the past and try to replicate that to the best of their ability. I think, you know, why Renaissance fairs go on. It's why Civil War reenactments go on. And people have passions, and I think that's probably part of it. I do think that, you know, in a way, it's interesting to study Claude Shannon because if I imagine him alive today, I actually think he would find ways to still be unbothered or untroubled by a lot of the noise that I think gets to the rest of us, right? When we were studying him, one of the things that we realized was he had a lot more incoming letters than outgoing letters. And what would happen is mail would come for him, and he would toss it into this bin, and the bin had a label. It said, "Letters I've procrastinated on sending for too long." And he would just toss it into this bin, and in all of this correspondence would go. And this is not, you know, bills and mail that he didn't necessarily ask for. This is invitations to give prestigious lectures. It's awards. It's honorary degrees. I mean, these are real things that he was just sort of casually setting aside. He had an ability to tune out all of that. Now, I think people now are designing systems to do that. There is actually a movement for people to use flip phones. Celebrities are now starting to go back to flip phones and making it a kind of countercultural statement. You have people who are finding ways to turn off their devices. There are apps you can pay for programs you can pay for on your computer that will simply disable the internet for a certain amount of time. People are paying money to disable the internet to take them back just a step. And granted, it doesn't take them back to the days of analog. And we may, you know, there may not be a way to get back there, but I do think there's something powerful in the lesson from Shannon about how to focus and how to keep your inputs minimal and important, and the kind of movement that you see now to a bit of analog back in our digital lives.
Who do you think, I guess in conclusion, who do you think today is our Claude Shannon? Do you think it's Elon Musk? Do you think it's somebody else? Do you think there is not going to be somebody like Claude Shannon for a long time, or his time has passed, there's not room for another Claude Shannon?
Well, that's a bit above our pay grade, but I guess I'll say this. It's probably not someone like Elon Musk, just because Musk is so good at publicity, and Musk is so good at being the public face of Sony Technologies. But the neat thing about Shannon is that in the digital age that we live in, you know, he's not best known as someone who's a builder of computers or of systems. He's best known as someone who builds the intellectual architecture around them. So if there is a Claude Shannon, and I'm sure there are people of his caliber still out there, he's probably, you know, toiling away maybe in an industrial lab somewhere or in a computer science department, maybe working on the next big breakthrough. But the neat thing about Shannon is that he shows that the breakthroughs that change our lives don't just start with someone developing a new gadget. They start with someone coming up with the idea and the intellectual architecture behind it, maybe by writing a paper, maybe by putting it in the hot new PhD dissertation. If there is a Shannon out there, he or she is probably someone in their 20s or 30s, you know, when Shannon did that kind of work. So I think the neat thing is it's hard to predict where that's going to come from. We're certainly not in a position to do so. But I will say that what makes a Shannon possible is not just that degree of genius that he had that's hard to replicate or wish into being, but it's also the organizations that gave him the freedom, the flexibility, the time to be playful with his mind that made him such a remarkable and innovative figure. It wasn't just that Shannon was Shannon, it's that he was fortunate enough to have mentors like Vannevar Bush at MIT. He was fortunate enough to later on be at a place like Bell Labs that just let him pursue his creativity and trusted that it was going to end up somewhere good. So I think the goal isn't so much to look for that next Shannon, as to think about what kinds of institutions are we building? Are we building institutions that foster that sort of creativity and allow that sort of playfulness and then very smart grown-up adult playtime? And if there are, I don't think we need to worry about the next Shannon out there. I think genius takes care of itself. And the goal for the rest of us is to build institutions that allow it to do what it does.
That's a great spot to end it here. So I really appreciate you guys both being here. The book was great. I'm glad you discovered him so that I could discover him, because in all likelihood, I never would have read anything about him. So I really appreciate the effort that you guys have made, and in such an eloquent and articulate way.
Well, we appreciate you taking a close read. The way I know you read it is that you mentioned Joseph Dube. No one else has brought that name up to us, except for the folks who we spoke to during the writing of it. So we appreciate you taking such a close read at it, and we hope your listeners enjoy it. I think for anybody in and around these spaces, but really for anybody who's a gadgeteer, a tinkerer, somebody who plays around with physical objects, I think Shannon can be a real inspiration.
Well, I think that one of the reasons you guys ended up getting an interview, or I got an interview with you guys, was because I had interviewed James Glick, and there's many quotes from him in your book. And I think you approach this book, and this is the highest compliment, you approach this book the same way he approaches his work. And that's why it's so readable. And, I have an independent bookstore, and this book will definitely be on the front table. So thanks so much.
That's awesome. And Glick is someone we admire so much in
I know.
The models. That's a really high compliment. I appreciate it.
Sure. We were talking with Jimmy Soney and Rob Goodman about A Mind at Play, how Claude Shannon invented the information age. And I just wanted to say, it's like a guy I never would have heard of, and I'm so glad they discovered him themselves and did such a great job, much in the same way that James Glick does in his book, his many books, telling us about something that we didn't know before and explaining it in such a great way. So continue to join us. We have some really good upcoming guests, including Alex Gilvary, my old buddy, to discuss his highly anticipated sophomore novel, Eastman Was Here. Poet and editor Jill Bielowski is going to discuss her memoir, Poetry Will Save Your Life. And Annalie Newitz, I'm looking forward to, will stop by to discuss her latest work, Autonomous. And we have many others. So be sure to come back next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.